traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Here we go in 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, a podcast to promote and improve your practice as an athletic trainer. Today, Dr. Ethan Kreisworth takes us ringside. So he is in charge of Black Belt Sports Medicine, where they provide athletic trainers for combat sports like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I always struggle when I have to say that, so like a tongue twister for me. And that's actually something I'm kind of interested in. So this one will be called sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/blackbeltsportsmedicine. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/blackbeltsportsmedicine. That'll be have ways to get a hold of Dr. Kreisworth and if there's specific links that we mentioned there. So recently I saw on Gopher Ellis a listing for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu athletic trainer, but personally I was like, I don't know if I'm ready to jump in there like as a solo guy. I don't know the sport very well, and there's a lot of stuff. And the big thing is what I see you posting on Instagram, where there's all sorts of cuts or relocations or, you know, different things like that. That I'm like, I'm not 100% sure I'm ready for that by myself. You know, I mean, obviously I've worked here in the high school for 20 years, but working ringside, what are some of the things that give you pause, that make you think, I haven't seen this before?
Right. Well, first off, thanks for having me on. It's really cool. I've been following your podcast for a while. And I think it's great that athletic trainers are just starting to really get into the realm of spreading the word of what an athletic trainer is, what we can do, and what we can't do, you know? So it's a great question. And when I first started jiu-jitsu and I was a sole athletic trainer in charge of mini mats by myself, I too was scared and saying, I wonder if I should be here or not. And, you know, it's been, since 1997 or 98, I covered my first tournament. So it's been many, many years. And I came onto the scene being a jiu-jitsu practitioner. So I just shared my services to these large events. And these large events were nothing like they are today. I mean, you know, 20 plus years ago, these events were 4 mats, 6 mats, you know, half a day, maybe 1 full day. Now they're, you know, 47 mats, 4 days, you know, they're ginormous. So hence why Black Belt Sports Medicine evolved from basically one lone athletic trainer to multiple athletic trainers. So what gives me pause? Well, back then, you know, dislocations, unconsciousness, C-spine protocol, all those gave me pause. But I quickly said, hey, I need more help. And I'd bring on some other athletic trainer friends, maybe 1 or 2, and, you know, we'd cover these events. Now, you know, the company needs to bring on as many as possible, depending on the mat size. So we have a formula where we hire athletic trainers per number of mats, per number of medical areas, to cover these all day events. And, you know, what gives me pause now is running a company. That's what gives me pause. Especially a company that's, you know, potentially, you know, these sports, everything's so litigious these days, that worries me more than any. I can handle any injury. I've seen them all pretty much. But the biggest one is, you know, trying to make sure that an event with my, you know, with my cohort, Shelby Daly, who's my administrative assistant, who helps me find all these athletic trainers across the states. You know, finding athletic trainers for these events, you know, is really that's the pause. That's the hard part.
So you said across the state. So you work across the whole United States?
Yeah. You know, when COVID happened, you know, the International Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation is the largest jiu-jitsu federation in the world. And they came out here from Brazil. I think it was either 2000 or 2001. They had their first American tournament out here, under the guise of International Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation. That, you know, was, you know, only in California, right? They came out to California. So Rio de Janeiro and California, Orange County, Los Angeles beaches are almost the same. I mean, they're beautiful areas and it just fit their lifestyle. And they start coming out in groves. And, all these jiu-jitsu practitioners found out that, jiu-jitsu is like crack. Everybody loves it. And they, once they get on it, you can't get off of it. And everybody loves jiu-jitsu. And they found, it's extremely profitable to come teach jiu-jitsu. And then the tournament started coming out here. And it only stayed in California. And it started branching out to California, maybe one in Texas annually, maybe one somewhere else annually. But then when COVID hit, it was shut down, right? And that's a very large federation that can't lose a lot of money. So they went to states where contact was allowed, and that was the southern states pretty much during COVID. And then it just stayed, and then it just spread. They started going to areas where they had never touched before, small markets. Los Angeles, Florida, New York, and roughly Texas are bigger markets. But then they said, hey, we need to host events, in Oklahoma. We need to have events, somewhere in another state. So I thought it would all come back just to California pretty much for the big tournaments. But nope, it stayed because they found that was profitable. And now there's events all over the, all over the states. So we try to cover all those.
So going back to where I talked about Gopher Ellis had a posting for a job here. I think it was in Houston, the greater Houston area. Was that Black Belt Sports Medicine?
You know what? I'm not sure. I have to check with Shelby if that was Black Belt or not. Usually we don't post in Gopher Ellis. We've had luck without it, but it could have been. It could have been. But there's other federations. The IBJJF is who I cover. There's the NABJJF, and there's other even smaller federations and what I call just one-offs. So it could have been. I don't know. But usually we cover the really large events. We do cover the small 1 days, but mostly we cover the larger 2, 3, 4, or 5 day events.
All right, so if we're looking at signing up for one of those events in our area as an athletic trainer, what should I expect? I mean, like I said, if I'm following you on Instagram, I see the dislocations or the AC sprains that are sticking way out, or all that different stuff. You see, you see the Instagram, the worst stuff.
Right.
But what am I realistically expecting? Is that once every hour you're seeing something like that? And then am I the only athletic trainer?
Right. Great question. I always say the athletic trainers at an event are kind of like the fire department. They could be not be used all day, or they can be used consistently all day, as athletic training is. Being a head athletic trainer for a college for many years, I'd be in the training room all day and nine sports are outside, and I wouldn't get called. I'd just stay central, or I'm running like crazy in my golf cart going somewhere. So you don't know what to expect. It's the emergency department, so you could have a very busy day or a not, non-existent day. Dislocations, I would say you're looking at, you'd be lucky if you got maybe one or two per weekend, possibly. They don't come that often. Most of these people now, even the lowest belt, which is the white belt and the blue belt of jiu-jitsu, which is only a 1 to 2 year belt within the sport, train probably 4 or 5 days, 6 days a week. So they know what they're kind of getting into. Way back in the day, a white belt or a blue belt coming to a tournament maybe trained twice a week, so they were really having some issues related to competition life. Competition is a whole different animal, but now people really know their bodies, I believe, know their bodies well. They train so much. So if they dislocated, they probably dislocated before at their dojo, and they kind of know, and so they're a little bit more relaxed. We get the acute dislocations that have never dislocated before, but I would say one or two dislocations for a larger tournament. As far as, lacerations and stuff like that's rare too. Believe it or not, it's rare. It's not boxing. The headbutting and stuff like that, or the slip of elbows and things just don't come as often as people think. And just like you said, it's biased information on Instagram. I don't want to post, or Black Belt doesn't want to post just us sitting around a treatment table. We want to post what's maybe fun and interesting to see to other athletic trainers,
For sure, for sure. If there's something that you really enjoy dealing with, whether that's suturing or the dislocations or something like that, what do you enjoy most dealing with as an athletic trainer in combat sports?
Yeah, we bring on a lot of students. So I love giving back. I'm an instructor myself, so I just love to share, the new ACL to these students who have never seen a pause Blockman's, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, I finally get to see it. I'm so excited." I'm like, "Yeah, get your hands on it." Because, if somebody tears their ACL or PCL or other collateral ligaments, whatever the case may be, and they can get their hands on it within, 30 seconds of injury, you get that, great golden period where you really can feel it, most I would say most injuries, we don't get the feel. It's textbook information, and you'll be lucky. I used to tell the orthopedic doctors that I wanted them to rotate the local orthopedic doctors if they had anybody who wanted to rotate through us. I said, "You're going to see more ACLs here over this 3-day span than you will all over football season." And, so we start to get more people coming through because they get your hands on real ACLs, and that's what they need. They need that hands-on experience like an athletic trainer. So, giving back to those students is really fun. Of course, I just started suturing. I'm in California, so we're, no state practice acts out here. It's kind of a wild west. So I work underneath the physician, and he allows me the medication and suturing, and I've been trying that, and that's relatively new. I've only been doing that for about a year or two. So if I get a really good LAC, I'm pretty excited because it's something new, and I've been in this field for, late, I don't know, many, many years, since 95 or 96 as a certified. So bringing on a new practice that I like to enjoy is fun for me. I've seen a lot of ACLs.
Yeah, that's something interesting. We just recently started becoming preceptors for the University of Houston Master's Athletic Training Program. And that's one of the things I always do. If there's an injury, I'm like, hey, why don't you check it out? These kids that are brand new, they're, first year into their master or first semester into their master's. I'm like, hey, this is what an ACL feels like. Hey, this is what this feels like, And I love having that because my coworker, Sophia, she had never felt a positive ACL until she came to work with me. And I was like, hey, why don't you go check out that kid? I'd already checked him out. I knew what was going on. I was like, why don't you just check him out and see what you think? She's like, oh, that was the first time I felt it. And like,
I
boom,
know.
we're medical professionals, we're licensed, certified medical professionals, and we just felt it for the first time in real life. That's crazy.
And you'll get if there's a chance to reduce, I'll let them just feel their hands over my hands, feel what kind of tension that is. Those are you only have, like I said, that golden period is such a small window. And these athletes, they're really thankful for having, solid medical at the events. And they're really thankful. So sometimes they rotate as many hands as possible on that ACL. So that guy's just got, drawered and pulled on, at least 6, 7 times where he doesn't want to be, but he's doing it for the cause of medicine. So kudos to those athletes. But they're all really kind. I haven't had any. It's rare that I get any pushback, like, "Don't touch me." "No, I don't want him to look at me. I don't want him to touch me." It's we're a great controlled science experiment here.
Yeah, so I worked a volleyball tournament, kind of similar to what you're doing. It's like 100 courts or whatever, and there's hey, we need the athletic trainer over here. She hurt her knee, and so I went over there and dislocated patella. And it's like, dang it, where's my student right now? Like, this would be perfect. You could see it. You could just see, watch, simple, put back in, and go from there. I love sharing those experiences.
I agree.
All right, so tell me a little bit more about the suturing. You said, that's something that's new for you. I know it's actually in the educational standards. I think it's in the educational standards for athletic trainers nowadays, right?
It's really great here. So in California, we're allowed to take the courses. So there's a lot of the Far West Athletic Training Association will do for their symposium coming up, they'll do a lab and course in lab. I took the course somewhere else at a university, but yeah, it's a new experiment, a new experience, and it fits so well. We should have been able to suture quite some time ago. I mean, in my sport, in the sport of jiu-jitsu, we get some pretty good facial locks, and head locks, and I had to, send them off. And a lot of these people are not even from country. They're outside the country. They're definitely outside the state. Whether they have insurance or not, that's always questionable too. So, they have no transportation. They're all alone. I mean, it really helps them out if I'm able to help them out, especially financially, if I'm able to suture for them. So, A couple of years ago, I thought, oh, when athletic training started to bring in suturing, and they wrote a position statement about it, I'm like, oh, I'd really love to do that. I've only sat, on the side, snipping sutures for the doc as they do it. So you learn as you go. A doc has let me throw in a couple sutures way before this course I took. But it truly aids in the treatment position for me. Obviously I'm in a bit of a unique situation working these side tournaments. Of course, for colleges, universities, and high schools, it may be different as far as liability, but so far so good. I've done about, I don't know, about 10 suturing so far, and I started working on it late last year. So I practice all the time. I have my pseudo skin that they send you, and you practice a lot with different types of needles, different type of suturing, how to inject. The injecting of lidocaine was all practiced through a doctor who's my oversight, and he showed me how to inject, what to do, how to use. And typically at these events, I'll have an oversight doctor too there. The bigger events. So I always tell people, if you feel comfortable reducing, if you feel comfortable suturing and you have some oversight, then please practice, because we're an evolving type of entity, athletic training. Athletic training, I mean, we're kind of like the jack of all trades, master of none. You could tape an ankle, you can auscultate lung sounds, you can talk about the adverse effects of diabetes, and now we can suture. So we're kind of like the master of all. I mean, the jack of all trades. I would love to master more suturing techniques. I think it could really help the athlete.
Right, so talk to me just a little bit about some of the concerns. Obviously here in the high school, there's sticking a needle into somebody. There's all the legal need that would have to be cleared by the district, and then the waivers signed by the parents probably, and that kind of thing. But then, we've also talked about having the needles here, the drugs here, the equipment here, the creating a clean environment, making sure the wound is clean, and those type of things. So talk to me about how you manage some of those concerns as a business owner, as an athletic trainer, working ringside.
Yeah, those are large questions. So, obviously in different states, you may have standing orders. Here in California, we don't have state practice acts yet. So again, that gives me a lot more leeway than it does maybe you, where we're not licensed athletic trainers, the last state not to have licensure in athletic training. So for me, being a business owner, that's a bit of a benefit, right? I'm not held in a box whatsoever. Where you're held in a box in Texas, and other states are held in boxes. So to me, whether I learn how to dry needle or inject or suture, it's on me and my liability. But as far as a practice act that I'm trying to stand under, we don't have yet. When we do, then I'll have to reconfigure what I'm doing. But right now, with my guidance of my physician, that's what I do. So I feel I'm helping people out. Legality can always come, but I try to do the best I can, do no harm, maintain HIPAA violations. When I do suture, it's not Matt's side. I'll basically, if I have a lack and need suturing, and he agrees to the suture or she agrees to the suturing, I'll take a treatment table. We'll go behind scenes. I'll make a clean field, and I'll go through all the preparatory necessities before suturing, and then go ahead and get it done. And then, of course, it's always a referral, like, please see your physician when you get back. Make sure the wound's clean. Make sure the sutures are out within 7 to 10 days, depending on the location, and so forth. So as I took the course, you go through all the normalcies of taking care of a suture correctly and cleaning it prior to suturing. Of course, it's not, I'm not just driving needles into people and sewing them up with yarn.
Right.
Right.
And have you had any issues with people not following up, going to the doctor? Because I mean, we had a kid basically bite through his, like broke his tooth and bite through his lip. And they're like, all right, well, we went to the doctor, but we don't have money to go back to the doctor to get him taken out or to get the tooth fixed. And so with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, those guys are basically, you don't have any contact with them afterwards for the most part. And so there's
That's right.
no real follow-up. And so have you had any sort of issues or concerns with them not getting seen by a doctor?
The only people I do follow up with are the ones that I want to follow through time. So the suturing I do follow up with because it's new to me. Anybody that's sent by EMS, I follow up with, or my staff will follow up with. Anybody, who has any major concerns, I'll follow up with. Your typical, knee sprain, shoulder sprain, and so on, I don't follow up with. So if there's anything I need to follow up with that I feel is going to be, a potential red flag, or just want to see how well they're doing, somebody tore their ACL, I'll follow up with, because I also like to collect data to see how people are doing, or if they really did tear, if we go back to ACL, if they really did tear their ACL. Over the years, going back to ACL really quick, or even ligaments of the knee, you think you see what you see, and then you follow up and you said, oh, it's just tissue creep. Tissue creep being that, their posterolateral corner is blown out because they've been playing in that position for 20 years. So their knee is lax because it's all tissue creep. So what you saw, what you felt, even though it was unilateral in comparison, wasn't really what you felt. So I like to follow up on those too. So just to give an example, 1 year I was collecting data on ACLs. I think we had six ACLs in a 3-day tournament. We actually had a lot of ACLs that event. I think maybe only I think half of those were actually confirmed on MR because they were tissue creep. And that happens in the sport of jiu-jitsu. You stay in these sustained bent knee, external rotated tibial, internal rotated positions that puts a lot of stress on the collateral ligaments as well as the cruciate ligaments. And the knee will feel really sloppy if they have a knee injury. They think they do, then come to you. The knee will feel really sloppy in comparison. And you're like, oh, it's an ACL or it's a PCL or it's an LCL. And in fact, that year when I did follow up, they not all were. So I was like, that's interesting.
All right, so kind of, I don't know about switching gears, but going back to like the where I work, the big volleyball tournament, I get these 12-year-old girls coming over crying. Like, get the 18-year-old girl, they never been hurt, whatever it is, crying. Do you see that with fighting? Do you see like the over emotional with the combat sports?
Well, we have really, really large kid tournaments, and I just don't like to work them anymore because of that. The kids' tournaments are I should have went back. What gives me pause? Working children's tournaments. That's you brought that up because the parents are your typical soccer mom type of craziness. I mean, it is ballistic, and I've worked plenty of volleyball before. I've seen that too, but watching their kids fight brings out the human animal in these parents. I mean, the screaming and the yelling and the it's her fault, it's his fault, and the complaining to the referee, it's just ugh. And the kids are crying like crazy. It's just a pandemonium scene, controlled pandemonium scene. And I just don't like to see it, especially being a father. And I'm highly competitive myself, being a black belt in the sport myself, but I just don't like to see the kids like that anymore. So that's the one I don't work personally. I'll work the bigger tournaments, but hopefully people want to work those events. A lot of crying, and it's hard to diagnose and assess with a lot of crying. You don't know what's going on. And I could tell you that I do remember one child who had an elbow forearm injury, and he was crying, and I probably had 20 elbow forearm injuries that day. Didn't think much of it, and it turned out to be a green stick fracture because I followed up on that kid. And so it's hard to tell with the kids. It's really, really hard to tell.
For sure. Yeah. And so with those, it's always like, well, if it's still hurting tomorrow or it's hurting more, you want to go follow up with your doctor, make an appointment. I don't think you need to go to the emergency room right now, but it's your kid. You do what you feel like is best. And those things are
Yeah, a
always.
lot of that. Of course, the adults only cry when they a lot of people that are outside the country are really emotional with the win and a loss. So we see that too. But as far as injury, it's very stoic. We get a lot of people who are just straight up warriors. They will not tap or submit to a straight arm bar or a straight leg lock or ankle, different ankle holds and all these submission holds. They just will not tap. They came too far, they've spent too much money, and they'll let that thing dislocate or break, believe it or not. The Japanese have always been extremely kamikaze like that, where they just did not tap. And we knew when the Japanese contingencies were at these events, which they still are, they are not submitting to a choke. They'd rather just get choked out, or any type of lock. So I always found that kind of interesting. Different people are different warriors, but going back to the kids. Yeah, it's really hard to, as an athletic trainer, it's really hard to assess when you have a kid who's hyperventilating and crying, you know?
All right, so at the beginning, you talked about when somebody was unconscious giving you pause, and you just talked about somebody being choked out. What does that look like in the sport? Do they get choked out as soon as they let go, they catch their breath and they wake up? Or is that somewhere you have to go over, do the sternal rub, or what does that look like?
Yeah, no, it's you can do painful stimuli. They come back. So the choking out is basically dual compression in the carotid. So they lack blood flow to the brain. So it's only a couple of seconds. If the choke is on correctly, like they can use a collar choke to go across the carotids, or they can use what we call a mataleon or a rear naked choke that can go across the carotids. And once the carotid are, occluded, then you go unconscious. And once the choke is let go, blood flow resumes and they wake back up. So it's never been a problem. Treatment has always been always questionable. And there was actually one post recently on social media about, don't lift their legs up. Typically the guy's on their back, right? Or the person's on their back. They could be face down. Neck injuries are extremely rare in jiu-jitsu. We don't have a lot of head and neck injuries. I'll talk about that later. But so we turn them over, and we lift their legs. Now, the process of lifting your legs is to increase blood flow back to the brain, like a shock position. But you also have to remember that they've been for the last, couple minutes or so, their heart rate is already cardiac. So they're going to have increased blood flow. Their heart rate's already just flying. So once a choke is released, blood flow gets pushed right back to the brain. They wake up, and a lot of times they wake up combative because they were sleeping. And I've been choked out before many times, and you're like in a dream state of that you're still competing. So neurologically, those synapses are firing and you're still going, and you wake up and you start competing. And you've seen videos of people, trying to attack the referee, trying to attack their opponent again because they didn't know they were choked out. So that's typically the case. So going back, just to clarify, the referees are extremely good now. I mean, years ago, they wouldn't get down to see if a choke was really on, but now the referees, they're constantly monitoring, constantly watching, especially with the kids. And once they look like they're unconscious or they're out, or even the other opponent will say he's out, the choke is released, and then they have a couple seconds. And I've seen people stay unconscious for maybe 10, 15 seconds. That's a long time to be out there, while that guy is still trying to, gain consciousness. So whether you sternal rub, whether you shake and shout, whether you lift the legs, blood flow will resume. And we haven't had any problems, knock on wood, with any type of clotting or anything like that. So hasn't been a problem.
All right, you mentioned there's not a whole lot of neck and spine, head, neck, spine injuries, so.
Yeah. So I originally wrote my dissertation on the on data of this sport. So you can find actually my dissertation was not published, but my pilot data was published. You can find that in PubMed. I still have some other research coming out regarding ankle injuries and maybe some more data too. So, but for the most part, the game pulls guard. That means the game sits down on the ground really quick. It's not. It has judo play in it, has wrestling play in it, but the job of the or the result of this is trying to get someone to submit or beat them on points. And you could do that from sitting down. So because of that, no one's standing the entire time, and a lot of people will just what we call pull guard, they'll sit down right away. That takes away a lot of the axial loading that you may get when you get thrown or taken down like a wrestler or a judo player. So the data that I've taken over the years shows extremely small, insignificant injuries to the neck as far as acute trauma. Now, there may be a lot of neck issues related to the sport itself, but as far as acute trauma and brain injury, it's TBIs, it's very, 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 very small. Very small. I mean, it's rare that someone even reports a concussion at an event, maybe one, maybe.
Interesting. I mean, I can definitely understand the strains, because you're pulling and twisting and that kind of thing. But yeah, you're just there's not a whole lot of velocity when your head to the ground and a lot of blows to the head.
That's right. There's no striking in this sport, and there's not a lot of throwing. And you could potentially get two guys who are wrestlers who are in a jiu-jitsu tournament where they're defending a takedown or defending a throw, and same with the two judo players. Usually, as a competitor, if you feel a guy setting up like a judo player, you pull guard. You sit down right away, and there's no point lost there. So a lot of people play to other people's strengths too. They're like, okay, I know this guy's going to try to take me down. I'm just going to sit down and play my game, which is a different game. And when that happens, it really takes out the risk of the head injury and the neck injury. Yeah.
So what are you seeing so far as an ankle and knee injury in your data?
Well, what's interesting is I always talk about this thing called the posterolateral corner, which is PCL, LCL, arcuate ligament complex. That posterolateral corner has become a lot more evident over time. So jiu-jitsu players that are my age, or have had a lot of years on their, they play this position called De La Hiva. De La Hiva is a where the hip is rotated. The knee is the tibia is internally rotating. It's woven through the opponent's legs. It's really hard to imagine unless you do the sport, but it's a lot of knee flexion, hip flexion, and internal external rotations, and that basically puts strain on the posterolateral corner. It's almost like being in a varus position, a flexed varus position, for a long time. And then you think about the hours you spend on the mat at your training dojo. That could be 6 to 10 hours a week in that position. You create this thing called tissue creep, and people's knee will start to get kind of sloppy. They may develop meniscal lesions due to that. I can't say for sure because I haven't written the research on that, but there is no research on that position. That position is very evident in the sport, and people use it a lot. And I know it's creating more knee injuries. It just needs to be validated. So I see that a lot. As far as acute injuries, we do get the acute, the lower belts will get the acute MCLs, ACLs, because they just don't know, a lot of position sense. But the worst thing you can do in jiu-jitsu is keep on fighting position. The sport is. It should be a nice flowy sport, but when you compete, you just don't get that as much. So you get people fighting, and then we get people fighting and resisting. You start to get eccentric injuries or ligamentous injuries.
All right, so kind of going, circling back, I'm going to sign up for working one of these tournaments with you. What's a tip, trick, or hack that I need to like pack in my kit? Like you see wrestlers, they have the Vaseline on their glove and the little whatever, the little armband. And so, what's something special or unique that I would need to prepare
Yeah,
for?
we do a lot of that too. You almost can get by with the fanny pack with these events. All the typical stuff of athletic training should be used. But yeah, gloves, gauze, skin lube, nose plugets, are your basics. That's what you can use basically. But as far as like anything major, we don't tape ankles like we do like it's a basketball or volleyball tournament. There's rarely any taping, maybe just finger taping. So 1/2-inch tape would be great. They may come for some taping here and there, but it's definitely not at the level of any volleyball event. So gloves, gauze, just more of your expendable items. Yeah, I mean you're sitting there, and you're just waiting. A referee will call you on the mat, and you'll go check see if the guy has a lack, or check his, you do a quick enter draw or Lockman's on his knee, or you're checking his fingers if it's located, and that's about. Just a quick on and off the mat, just a really macro assessment of an injury and coming off the mat, and they can come see you if they need to after their fight.
Very cool. I know recently you've been on several different podcasts. I know, like with Randy and Sandy out there at AT Corner with Eli Kassab. There was, I think, two other ones that I've seen you post. One of them I didn't know of. Were you on the AT Athletic Training Chat with Joel Ludke? Did I
No,
see that?
I just did sports medicine on tap there in the Eastern Seaboard, and I am supposed to go on. I did Eli because Eli works with me a while back. It's been a while since I did Eli, and then with Sandy, I know I'm supposed to get on with them kind of soon.
I gotcha. And actually, Dr. Chrysworth and I spoke with Mike Stella when we were live in Las Vegas at the NATA event. So if you want to go way back in the archives, and you can check that out. So, do you have any other thoughts or feelings, anything that athletic trainers need to know about working combat sports?
We never put anybody alone. I would never have anybody work an event alone. So you're always going to be with at least one, if not two or three athletic trainers, so you'd never be alone. So that's the biggest thing, and I don't want people to come to events scared. You know, if you have any wrestling, high school wrestling or college wrestling coverage, I mean, that's pretty much the same thing. You know, other than, you know, the blood stops may be a little bit different, but yeah, it's not detrimental. And I'm sorry that if Instagram and the things scare you away, I don't want to be anybody scared away. I want people to enjoy it. So it's definitely not hard. There's a lot of, you know, there's some length in time, of course, but you know, you're never alone, so it shouldn't be any type of major issue related to it. And you know, we always call EMS if we have any other issues, and a lot of these events have their own EMS there. They may have their own EMTs at the event because that's legal for them. So you're never alone.
Fantastic. And on Instagram, it's Black Belt Sports Medicine. So again, it's black, this podcast is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/blackbeltsportsmedicine, where I'll have links there. Any other way that you like to connect with athletic trainers?
So we're on Facebook as well as Black Belt Sports Medicine, Instagram, like you mentioned, Black Belt Sports Medicine. My personal is at dr.kreis, Dr. Chrisworth. That's my personal handle. They can email us at Black Belt Sports Medicine. So we get a lot of people who email us, say, hey, I'm interested. I'd love to check it out. So emailing Black Belt Sports Medicine. So I think if you type in anything Black Belt Sports Medicine, hopefully I'll get you a shirt back there. It'll be front and center, nice and red, that we can also advertise. So I definitely appreciate your time and bringing me on.
Fantastic. And then Dr. Chrisworth also has does some work with smart tools. So obviously you can, if you're looking at the video, you can see Suji here. I've talked about the Delphi unit. I've talked with smart tools on here before. So he's doing that. If you want to find out more about smart tools, then you can talk to Black Belt Sports Medicine as well. So Dr. Chrisworth, appreciate you joining me, reaching out, being part of the podcast, growing our profession, doing crazy things and just helping athletic trainers and, you know, orthopedic surgeons, whatever, grow in the profession and taking care of people. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate all your time.
For Jeremy, Ethan, the Sports Medicine Broadcast, that is a wrap.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.